Go ahead with our recording.
Thank you, Ricardo. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings teleconference on the 19th of December. And on the call, we have Hugo de Falla, Juan Manuel Rojas, Alan Greenberg, Christina Dorian, Gabriela Schlack, Faisal Shah, Luke Schaefer, Cecilia Nehrmann, and for staff, we have Marika Koenig and Barry Cobb, and myself, Glenn de Saint-Gerie. We have apologies from David Maher, and I don't know anybody else has given their apologies. But before I hand it over to Alan, may I just remind you all, please, to say your name before speaking, because it makes the transcript much more worthwhile and accurate. Thank you, and over to you now, Alan.
Thank you, Glenn. Is there anyone with a change in statement of interest? Hearing nothing, seeing nothing. I'll note for the record that McKaylee has not shown up without apologies, and I'll take over his chair. The first item is to review the public comment form and ask if there's any comments on any of the responses. I have a couple, but I'll open the floor first.
I'm sorry for that. I thought I have one day more, so I'm a little lost this time. But it's okay.
No other comments. Let me raise mine, and as soon as I can find them. My first comment was on 14, and it's not really a comment, but a note. Trying to figure out what it meant. Hold on. My comment was, must the registrar be notified? But that doesn't make any sense. So I'm trying to understand what it was about. Sorry, did I say which comment I'm on? Anyone still there?
You said 14.
Yes, I think
it was
14.
I did say 14. Okay, fine. I wasn't sure. Okay. I think my comment is, do we want to explicitly put in our rules that the registrar should be notified by the complainant when the complainant is filed? I'm not sure. Is that currently a UDRP rule or a provider rule?
Hey, Alan, this is Christine. It is a provider rule. WIPO and NAF require it. I don't believe the Czech Arbitration Court does it.
Okay, I see that reference. Yeah, that was the reference. So the question is, just a note to ourselves, do we want to require that the registrar be notified at the time the complaint is filed?
Alan, this is Christine. Can I respond to that?
Sure.
I didn't put my hand up in the room. I'm sorry. Say, I wanted to mention that I don't think there's any harm in doing that. However, I mean, and the NAF does require it, and I think it's good. But I wanted to point out that most of the time, or not maybe not most of the time, but in a fairly significant number of times, the registrar doesn't actually get what the complainant sends because the provider has a special email address list for registrars. So the registrars are all asked to provide a list of an email for UDRP and compliance-related issues. And so we are given that list privately, and we use that list. So we don't just go and search for, you know, help desk at GoDaddy or whatever it is that people are using. We have an actual sort of a hotline, if you will. So I think it's fine, and I don't think that there's going to be any harm in adding that. But I would just caution us to think that that's going to solve a ton of problems, because I don't know that that's going to notify the vast majority of registrars. I still think in the vast majority of cases, the registrar is going to get its first notice from the provider.
Or first notice that they note, that they notice.
They are aware of, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, good point. Thank you. My next comment was on point number 20. And this is one of two comments. There was an earlier one. I'm not quite sure where it was, where in the registrar survey there was a reference to the registry providing functions. And our answer was the registry isn't involved. And on rereading it, the way I took it, and I'm not sure that's the way it was, the comment was meant, was that if we are going to, if we're talking about what might be a registry-defined lock, and we want common practices, that we have to make sure that that all registries offer that same lock. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but that's the way I read the comment and the reference to the registry. And I don't think we discussed that at the time. At least there's no reference to it in the working group response. So I took that as a veiled reference to registry locks, not that the registry is actively involved, because they're talking about registry providing functions under the common rules. Does that make any sense to anyone?
This is Christine. I guess I don't understand your concern. Could you try again?
Yeah, no. This comment and an earlier one talks about registries providing common functions, and our answer was the registry isn't involved in the UDRP process. And the way I read it is they're not talking about the registry being involved, but the registry providing common functions, which I took to be functions in the terms of offering a lock of some sort, which the registrar could use. So I'm not sure we have to do anything, but I think our answer is wrong because I don't think the answer is addressing what they were talking about.
Okay, Alan, this is Christine. So you are suggesting that, for instance, VeriSign and PIR would allow different controls to their registrars such that the registrars may be unable to implement a lock in exactly the same way because of the way the registries work.
I think that's what the comment was alluding to, yes.
Okay, are there any registrars on the call that know if that's a correct thought?
Or registries.
Yeah, or registries, yeah.
I would have thought locks are defined in EPP and they're all uniform, but I don't know that for a fact. And since in both cases, 20 and an earlier one, they talk about registry functions, providing functions, that's why I thought that may be what they were alluding to.
This is Christine. I think that's a really good question. I'd be very interested to hear from a registrar or registry as far as if there's a discrepancy, someone who does allow registration for domain names and .com, .net, .org, et cetera, is there a difference between the various registries or .info or whatever?
Maybe, is Volker on the line?
Looks like he just got on.
Yeah, I just got on. I didn't get the question.
Okay. My comment, we're doing comments on the public comment tool, and in two particular questions, 20 and an earlier one, the answer to 20 was a common set of rules would be desirable only if each registry provides the same functions. And our original response was, we don't know what you're talking about because registries aren't involved in the UDRP process. And what their comment was talking about is not the registry being involved, but the registry providing uniform functions. That is, every registry provides the same functions. So I think they're alluding to things like registry locks. And the Christine's question, and implicitly mine, is do all registries offer the same functions, or are there, in fact, differences in what lock capabilities the different registries offer?
Well, to my knowledge, there's a VeriSign that has a very explicit lock feature that even costs money to implement. I don't think that this is uniform. Most have the simple EPP commands of client transfer prohibited, client delete prohibited, and client update prohibited. But this is not always the case, I think. I would have to ask someone of our tech guys for more detail.
Okay, so I suspect my reading is correct, and whoever gave this answer or these answers was alluding to the fact that the locking offerings by different registries are, in fact, different.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah. And I had no other specific comments. I do have a question, and I should have asked this at the very beginning, being a UDRP novice. How many UDRPs are we talking about concurrently at any given time? You know, I don't have a handle whether it's 1 or 100. And,
Alan, this is Christine.
Yeah.
We have around 300 currently open and pending at any given time. WIPO has slightly more than we do. They also have more country codes, so I'm not quite sure where they're at on straight-up UDRPs. But I would, and then if you give a, you know, Czech Arbitration Court a handful as well, I don't think we'd be too far off in saying we got about 750 or so open at any given time.
Okay, and that implies for a moderately large registrar, they also have a good number open at any given time.
I think you're correct, yes.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is we've been talking about making sure that the rules allow changing some functions during lock, you know, whether it's your own phone number or whatever it is. And I was just wondering if, you know, that kind of thing might well involve manual operations, because if you are generically taking the domain out of the user's control, as some registrars do, or implement other changes that we want to allow may well have to be handled manually. And I was just wondering what the implication is, and it sounds like it potentially for a large registrar might be a heavy load. Although I don't know how many people actually want to make changes, so that softens it a little bit. So just something to think about as we go forward. Volker, you know. Marika.
Yes. I was just looking at my UDRPs that I currently have open. That's 31. That's all processes from receiving the first report till waiting for the complainant to provide the data that we can use to transfer the domain name to him. Active UDRPs, I would guess, about half, so 15
Okay. Currently
pending.
Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to clarify, based on the comments you made, are you suggesting any changes to the public comment review tool, or those were just more clarifying questions?
Yeah, no. For 20 and the earlier one that also references registry functions, I think our answer is wrong. I think, you know, our answer was a bit glib in saying registries aren't involved, and I think they were alluding to different functions offered by registries, and I think the right answer is noted. That is, if we end up defining something, we need to do some homework and make sure that whatever we're defining is implemented or implementable by all registries.
Okay, this is Marika. I'll update then. So that was comment 20, and which was the other one? I think we said it somewhere else, right?
It was somewhere earlier. I don't remember the exact number, but it's going to be hard to find. The word registry isn't used very often in these answers.
I'll check.
And I had one other question before we go on to anyone else, not regarding the public comment tool, but a general question. It came up yesterday in the Thick Who Is PDP. And there is a possibility for a thick who is, that the registry and registrar data in who is do not match. And I'm just wondering if a provider would find that would you for the UDRP providers, would you notice that, and what action would you take? I suspect I know the answer to the latter part, but I'm just asking. So if you find that the registry and the registrar claim that there are two different registrants or something, or the contact information is different, would you even notice it, and what action would you take?
Yep, this is Christine. We would likely not notice it because the UDRP requires us to gain that information, the WHOIS information, from the registrar. So our first option is to go for the registrar's data, and particularly when it comes to .com and .net, of course, we need the thick data, so we're not looking at VeriSign for any reason at all.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to provide us anything useful. So we go first to the registrar. We only go to the registry if the registrar and all other sort of domain tools-like options are not working, because we find that the registries are pretty notoriously inaccurate. So, you know, at least for, you know, .com and .net. So, yeah, we would not notice, and we would not likely do anything. We would stick with what the registrar told us.
Okay, even though the general feeling among registrars seems to be that for a thick registry, the registry is authoritative, because registries on occasion make changes and don't bother telling the registrar.
Okay, well, the UDRP, this is Christine again, the UDRP tells us to look for that information from the registrar.
Okay.
That's where we go.
Okay, that's nothing we're going to change within our scope, but I was just moderately curious, because we were talking about authoritativeness, and there seems to be a belief that if nothing else, because registries on occasion will change something on a court order, and it may or may not be reflected in the registrar's data.
That's very interesting, and thank you for passing that on.
I'm not sure how common an occurrence this is, but apparently it does happen.
But it's good to know. I always like to know about the exceptions.
All right. Any other comments on the comment tool, or is there anyone who didn't do it and wants us to keep it on the agenda for next meeting? I think I heard Gabby say something to that effect.
I think it's okay.
Okay.
If I have something in particular, I will say something next call.
Okay. All right. I think then we're on to the straw man, and I honestly do not remember how far we got. Maybe Marika can remind us.
This is Marika. Took a bit of time to get off mute. So basically what I did, I updated the comments and took out all the ones that we addressed, which were all the ones I think that Christine had submitted. So basically what is on the screen now, the comments, is where I think we left off. I did know that Christine sent something to the list just at the start of this call, which, of course, hasn't been incorporated there, so I don't know if that's something where you want to start or just leave that open on the mailing list now for people to review that and respond to.
I think so. Let's leave that one, since I haven't looked at it either. All right. Since last time I asked Christine to take us through her comments, I'll ask you to take us through yours.
Yeah, and this is Rick. Maybe just to clarify, these are not my comments, but these are some comments I got from colleagues, so if they're not clear, don't blame me. But basically
Marika, I'm just taking advantage of the fact that you label it from Marika.
Right. So the first comment is in relation to the draft recommendation one, and there the suggestion is that, you know, we talk about changing the requirements to notify the respondent at the time of filing of the complaint, but we're actually not being specific about whether that means that we want to require that complainants no longer send a copy of the complaint to the respondent, or whether it's just no longer a requirement to do so and possibly a best practice or a recommendation not to do so, but the complainant can opt themselves to actually send a copy there. So I think it's just a question of clarifying what we actually mean here.
Well, I put my hand up, but I'll let Christine go first.
Thanks. This is Christine. I am trying to follow protocol with saying my name and raising my hand. I'm sorry. So I would say that I think that this is a really good suggestion. I'm not sure who made it, but I think that, if we say the complainants may not send a copy, I think that really is going to provoke a headache for the providers, because for starters, the penalty only goes to complainant if they do send a copy. If there's cyber flight and the complainant caused it by notifying the respondent, that's, you know, that's complainant's fault. And then secondly, there are many complainants who are so locked into the process, they still send us hard copies. And the UDRP was modified in, like, 2009 to get rid of hard copies. So I think that it would be very hard to make it an absolute requirement that nobody notifies the respondent, but I think that it's excellent to say that it is not a requirement to do so, but certainly the complainant can send a copy to kind of whoever the heck they want.
Well, thank you, Christine. It's Alan. Moreover, I right now, if I remember correctly, two of the providers require that the complainant be notify the registrant, and one does not.
Well, Alan, I'm going to interrupt you right there because the registrant has to be notified via the UDRP. That's in the UDRP. The optional part is that we notify the registrar. Notifying the registrar is optional, and that's what the providers have encoded. Notifying the registrant is written into the UDRP. And
okay,
this,
now I'm confused.
The draft recommendation says we think that the UDRP should be modified so that the registrant is no longer notified at the moment that the complainant sends a complaint to the provider. That gives the provider a chance to contact the registrar, tell them that the domain name is, that there's a case pending, it's not in fact frivolous, at this point, please lock, do the deficiency check, collect the money, and then notify the respondent or the registrant after all of that is done, which is, you know, roughly seven or so business days, depending on how fast the registrar and everybody else does their job. So the requirement under the UDRP is that the complainant serve the registrant at the time it serves the provider. But the WIPO and NAF require that the complainant also send a copy to the registrar just in case that registrar is on top of things and wants to get that domain name locked and prevent some cyber flight.
Okay.
Then immediately the provider, you know, like I said, in some cases, if you file with us at 9 a.m. our time or 7 a.m. our time, by 8:30, we've already emailed the registrar saying, please lock this domain name. And by the way, if you don't have a copy of the complaint yet, we'll send it to you. Just let us know if you don't have it.
Okay.
And so we get the ball rolling right away. As soon as the registrar gets back to us, we can proceed on our merry way. Then we notify the respondent. The UDRP requires the provider to actually perform the service. And that's when the registrant / respondent gets an official copy of the complaint with all of the annexes, and they get told all their deadlines, and they get told, yes, the complainant is paid. And that's where the case sort of officially commences. But that beginning step is where we talked about not notifying the registrant in order to avoid cyber flight.
Right. Okay. No, I got it right. I got wrong which of the registrar or registrant is not required to be notified by the UDRP. But I think I understood the intent. But the question that I was raising was, and I think what this comment is alluding to, is do we say the registrant must not be notified by the complainant or need not be notified by the complainant?
And my response to that, Alan, this is Christine, was I think we say the complainant need not be notified by the registrant need not be notified by the complainant.
Okay.
Because some complainants have already sent cease and desist letters. They've already been in contact with the respondent. I don't think there's really any way to say you can never telegraph to a respondent that you're going to file a UDRP.
Okay,
I think it's up to the complainant.
Okay, but that wording would imply that the UDRP provider must not have a rule saying that the registrant be notified also.
That's correct, and no provider has that rule. Well, I shouldn't say that. We might have that rule, but we'd be very willing to strike that.
Well, but right now, if you say it's in the UDRP, then the provider doesn't need to have the rule.
That's correct, but some of the rules are redundant.
Okay. Gabriela.
Oh, hello. This is Gabriela Slack. My
question is more maybe about implementation, but I was wondering if maybe we can also recommend something for providers to have like a form online that would suggest exactly what to send and what not to send, and that will have some kind of a message to the complainant to that if he does send a copy to the respondent, it's more like something that he is doing on his own responsibility, but that is not a requirement. So if you fill a form and there's no place where to put the copy to be sent to someone else, it won't be sent, at least from the provider's perspective. Then if the complainant then does something else outside of the system or of the field, of the form that is filled, then it's something else. But at least to have something standardized from the providers, like a form online, that would be easier, and so you will educate easier to the whole public on how to implement these changes. I'm not sure if this is useful or not. Maybe Christine would be able to answer my questions.
Thank you, Gabriella. It sounds like you're suggesting that we might want to have a best practice or a suggested implementation to the providers to make sure that they're educating new complainants in the process.
Yes, because if you're going to make some changes and some people are used to do things in some certain way, then they wouldn't really know about the changes. Some of them will never get the information. And so if you have a form online that then can use technology, that will exactly, like, you fill the form, and then the technology is the one that takes care about how to do this and who to send this. So it will be easier for everyone, I think, maybe.
Okay, thank you. And Christine in the chat says, yes, I agree, user education is critical. Any other comments? Christine, do you want to come in on this one, or are you happy? And Marika has her hand up. So.
I'm great, thank you.
Yeah, this is Marika. Maybe that can be a kind of overarching recommendation where we say something that, you know, UDRP providers work together with ICANN as part of the implementation to develop educational and informational materials for, you know, respondents, complainants, and as well registrars, because in the end they are, of course, dealing as well with registrants on this end, but that we have a kind of overarching recommendation that talks about this element of making sure that there is indeed sufficient information and education about these changes in general, not only this specific one, but all of them. And then I think the different parties hopefully can come to some kind of mechanism of what would work best, that certain communications come through the UDRP provider, some might be available through registrars, I guess some will be as well on the ICANN website, so maybe that's something how we can capture that for, I think, the whole package that we hopefully will come up with at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I'll note that in other PDP discussions, it was noted that if you call something a best practice, then you're almost implying that everyone has to implement it. Otherwise, you know, they could be found negligent at some later time. So I think I'm not sure to what extent that interpretation is universally held, but we may want to think about that as we're wording our final results. Christine. Gabrielle, is that a new ad or an old one?
Oh, old one, sorry.
Okay, Christine?
Yeah, this is Christine from NAF. I just want to make one observation as well, that many registrars, again, I know of this document, I'm particularly mindful of the fact that this document is going to educate or supposed to be educating the registrars that really don't know what they're doing in this process, not the ones who currently do know what they're doing. We're not trying to fix, you know, the GoDaddies of the world here, or Volcker's registrar, the people who know what they're doing. But the observation I want to make is that there are some registrars who get a UDRP complaint from the provider, and they think that their job is to immediately go talk to the respondent and say, hey, we have this UDRP filed against you. What do you want me to do with it? So I'm wondering if there's an education piece as well in there to the registrars saying, and by the way, the complainant's not going to notify the registrant. You should not notify your registrant until you've locked the domain. Then if you want to notify them immediately, have at it. I mean, it's your client. You have a lot of, you know, obligations with respect to your client. You certainly have a relationship with that client. But I really think that perhaps part of that education is telling the registrars you know, you don't go consult with your client about what they should do next. The registrar is supposed to take action. If you want to notify your client after you've taken action, you feel free to do that.
Christina, that brings up a question. Do we want a rule saying you must not?
Well, I would like to see that, yes. I was trying to be gentle.
There aren't many times in life we get to write our own rules, so this is a time to mention it if we think. I'm not sure how well that would be received, but it is something we may want to consider.
Can I say something? This is Gabby.
Please,
of course, I'm not a registrar, so my comment might be out of place, but I think that maybe for them it will be useful to have a rule because they have a relationship with their clients. So if this is something that they must do, maybe it's easier for them.
That's a good point.
And this is Christina. I agree with Gabby, and I think that I believe my understanding is that what this recommendation list, when we're done, is going to a public comment period. So it would be interesting to include that and see if that hits a lot of flack or if most people do actually think that's reasonable.
Okay, that's good. I don't think we've discussed that before, so that's a good outcome of this. Any other comments on this one?
Yeah, this is Rika. Can
go
you
ahead.
Just, for my note, clarify which rule we're talking about that we want to add?
We're talking about a new rule saying, since presuming we say that the registrant need not be notified by the complainant, we should then have a rule saying that on receiving the notice about UDRP, and I guess that is either from the complainant or the provider, the registrar must not notify the registrant prior to locking. Christine, did I get that right? And Gabriella?
I think so.
This is Christine. I would say the only thing is we have not yet determined whether or not the registrar is acting at the time it receives something from complainant. So your comment that the registrar should not notify the registrant that it has received a complaint and it's going to do something with it, I'm not convinced because, well, I think it was just the way that it was worded. If the complainant sends a copy of the complaint to the registrar before the provider gets it, mm-hmm. we haven't yet decided whether the registrar is supposed to take any action at that point or whether they're going to officially wait for the provider to notify them that the case is not frivolous and is actually in the system. So that's my only comment, I guess.
But given, it's Alan speaking, but given that the provider is in the process of evaluating it, would we not want to prevent notification at that point anyway?
And this is Christine. Yes, assuming the provider actually is in the process of evaluating it. I think there is a very small minority, and GoDaddy's pointed out it's only happened twice to them, and they get a lot of these. But there's a very small minority of people who are concerned about frivolous complaints, that a complainant would simply send a complaint written on UDRP forms to a registrar, but not actually file with the provider itself. And so I know there is a small group of people who are concerned about that happening, above registrars or registrars.
But what is the downside of, in those small number of cases, making sure that the registrar does not pass that on to the registrant, since it's frivolous anyway?
Yeah, I see. So the point isn't that they're locking at that point. It's just that they're not passing it on at that point.
That's right.
Okay, yeah, then I can agree with that. I'm sorry if I've made that way more complicated than it had to be.
Marika.
This is Marika. I think that takes us immediately as well to the second comment. I mean, this question on whether the registrar may contact the registrant when the domain name has not been locked. And one of the comments made was there is that in certain cases, part of the verification, I think, is to request the registration's billing contact. And that's something where the registrar sometimes might need to go back to the registrant for, as I understand. So, indeed, this is the question of you know, is there no communication at all allowed between the registrar and the registrant once a UDRP notice has been filed, or are there certain circumstances whereby there may be a need for the registrar to reach out to the registrants, basically telling them that there is indeed, they've been asked to provide certain details, or, so basically indeed it's around this question on what are we trying to restrict and how strict is that intended to be?
Good points. Gabriella.
Okay, after Marika spoke, so I'm not sure if what I'm going to say is right. But I was wondering if maybe the rule would be like a general rule, but this is actually what Marika just said, maybe not. Like a general rule about registrars not contacting registrants until the lock is done. And then maybe if there's something to change, this will be like the exception.
Okay, thank you. Christy, I have a question, but and the question is, Christy may know the answer, so I'll ask it first. At what point, if it is privacy proxy, might the reveal be done under current rules? Is it done at sort of prior to the lock or after the lock?
This is Christine. From our perspective, it comes after the lock. So what happens is we notify We notify the registrar of the pendency of the complaint,
mm-hmm.
and we ask for certain details, including the name, contact information of the registrant. At that point, at some point, the registrar gives us the answer to our questions, including the name of the registrant. Now, that could say Privacy Proxy Service, or it could say Joe Smith. And maybe it was a Privacy Proxy Service and it got lifted, but then they email us back. By the time we get the email back, the domain name is locked, and the Privacy Proxy Service, if it's going to be lifted, should be lifted. So theoretically, and I don't know the exact order in which things happen at the registrar, but from our perspective, it's the lifting that happens and then the lock. But I wanted to just sort of walk through the steps really quickly here for my comment, which is if the complainant files a complaint with the provider and sends a copy to the registrar, I think it should be up to the registrar if it wants to lock at that moment. There are registrars that do it. They take that legal risk that they feel like there is a very low probability of problem in that situation. I don't think our rules should prevent that. However, if they do not choose to lock at that moment, I agree with Alan that the registrar should not notify the registrant that the complainant sent them a complaint. Then, once the provider has done their initial quick look at the complaint, then they send the formal notice to the registrar. At that point, the registrar is obligated to lock the domain name, if they have not already done so, and provide the information back that the provider needs to carry on. At that point, once the domain name is locked, again, the registrar can notify the registrant, we have locked this domain name, you may notice, whatever it is you want to tell your client. And I think that solves both problems. It solves the problem of when the respondent gets notice, but it also gives the registrar freedom to lock the domain name before the provider requests the lock, but it requires the registrar to lock at the time that the provider notifies them at a minimum. And I think that covers all of the possible options.
Okay, that means that for an arm's length privacy proxy service, not an in-house one, the domain must be locked before the privacy proxy service is contacted, because they are the registrant of record from the registrar's point of view.
Yeah, and that very well could be what we see now. We have, I don't know, maybe 40% of cases or something, I don't remember what the numbers are, going actually against the privacy service now.
Okay. Volker. Marika, do you want in first?
No, one comment on the one that Christina said, because that was exactly one of the questions I had as well in the updated straw man, whether indeed the listing requires communication with the registrant and our proxy privacy service, or whether this would be an automatic action that's taken by the registrar. As soon as they get a UDRP complaint notified that there's just an automatic listing of privacy if that is part of the agreement that the privacy proxy service has with its customer, or does that require any communication between the two parties?
Well,
and maybe Volker can actually answer the question at the same time.
I guess that would depend on whether it's an in-house proxy service or not.
Yeah, this is Christine. I've seen both, so I'm sure Volker has a lot more on that.
Volker.
Yes, Christine, I would disagree with the general tenant that we wouldn't be allowed to change the WHOIS record before responding or locking down when we receive a complaint, exactly for the reason that some of us registrars do provide our own privacy services and that we can look up the actual registrant of record on a minute's notice after we receive the complaint. Because of the different tie-ins that there are for the having a sufficient number of UDP decisions against an entity, because once it is established that the WHOIS privacy proxy is in some way affiliated with the registrar, that would, for example, exclude the registrar or affiliated entities from applying for new GTLDs under the current rule. Be found as a habitual or regular cyber squatter, whereas the customers of the registrant or the registrar or the privacy proxy provider that are engaging in some illicit behavior. So I think there should be allowance for removal of the complaint, the privacy proxy, once we receive the complaint, if that is done within reasonable time.
Christine, can you comment on that? Because I don't think I heard you say that wasn't allowed. Maybe I missed it, though.
Yeah, this is Christine. I think, Volker, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I agree with you that the privacy proxy service should be allowed to be lifted once the provider notifies the registrant and says, hey, who's the registrant? Absolutely. If that's the agreement and you want to lift it, go ahead and lift it. The problem for us is if you have this sort of the privacy proxy service is the secondary party, somebody that you have to go back to and wait for, and it takes them a week to get back to you, that's where it becomes unacceptable, in my opinion. If you as a registrar are running a privacy proxy shield and you've got an agreement with your client that you're going to lift that, then I think that's perfectly acceptable. I think the problem is if the registrant has contracted with some other third party, then that's none of our business. I mean, that's fine what they've decided to do amongst themselves. But then that doesn't necessarily require the registrar to go, you know, seeking out that third party and saying, hey, do you want to release your client's information? I think that's where the UDRP gets bogged down and where we wait 5, 10, 15, 20 days to commence a case because everybody's trying to contact everybody else in the process. But I absolutely agree that if the registrar has an agreement with the registrant that says, hey, we're going to release that, then absolutely you do that during the lock period, and I agree with that.
Yeah, Volker, I don't think I heard anything other than that. So when we come up with the final rules, if we missed it, please let us know. But I think we're okay on that. I'll wonder out loud, are we doing something which will essentially disadvantage arm's length proxy services and found, you know, can be found that we are doing something to impact their business because of this? I'm not sure who I'm asking the question to. I'm just wondering out loud, do we have any requirement that we not treat the two kinds of proxy services similarly?
Well, this is Christine.
Yeah.
I have just a question. Is the second kind of proxy service the one that's third party? I know we've talked about doing accreditation, but do they have any sort of contractual relationship with ICANN?
No.
I mean, the UDRP is a ICANN consensus policy that the registrar is bound to comply with as far as providing certain information. Now, the registrant, the proxy service, who is itself a registrant, who is just a beneficial owner for another person, they're contracted by virtue of their registration agreement, which is a totally different agreement. And it's not necessarily you know, something that the UDRP has even contemplated. It contemplates the providers dealing with registrars.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And in fact, that may be one of the rationales why signing a proxy service, signing an agreement with ICANN may help them. But, okay, we have Marika and Volker with hands up. I'm not sure if they're old or new.
This is Marika. Do you want to go first?
Go ahead, Marika.
I had basically, I think, two questions still there, because one thing, indeed, it might be on the third-party proxy privacy service. Maybe that needs to be clarified in the rules that, you know, a registrar within that 24 hours before it locks, it can at that point contact that third party, and as long as they give back whether they want to change or not within that 24 hours, as long as they don't contact the registrants, maybe that's something that needs to be explicitly stated. And I still have the question that I don't think was answered on whether at the moment the UDRP provider contacts the registrar or notifies them that there has been a complaint and wants verification of the data, is there any reason at that stage for the registrar to ask for certain information to the registrant? And if so, would there need to be an exception? Or is that information that the registrar should have in any case and there would be no need for them to go to the registrant at that point and give them, you know, kind of an advance notice before they have a chance to actually lock the domain name?
Marika, this is Christine. To answer your question, we request the following data. We want confirmation that the registrant has, in fact, signed a registration agreement and what the language of that is. We want to know the name and contact information for the registrant, including the billing address, so that we can send an email to, you know, a notice to that address. We want to know if the domain, we want a confirmation that the domain name is locked. We want to know the expiration date of the domain name, and we want confirmation that the domain name is not in some sort of a redemption period or expiration period already. Those are the questions that we ask as to whether or not the registrar would need to go back to the respondent to gain that data. I would suspect no, but I may not. I admit I'm not the authority on that.
Volker?
Yes, of course. There's two questions that have been asked that I would like to weigh in on. First is the arm's length issue that I don't really feel comfortable with distinguishing between third-party proxy services and proxy services that are provided by an affiliate of the registrar. I don't think there's many registrars that actually provide the service as the registrar. They all usually have a secondary company that's affiliated with them, and as soon as you get that second step to a different company, I don't think there's much difference anymore between a third-party providing that service or an affiliate of the registrar, because to the registrar, it's a third-party as well.
Mm-hmm.
Second point is that we've seen a couple of cases where complainants raise UDFP against a large number of domain names, which are all under the same privacy proxy, and when those are lifted, it turns out that those are different respondents after all. So if the privacy proxy is not cannot be lifted, and that is regardless of whether that's a third-party or a registrar-affiliated service, then he would have to defend cases, claims, for different respondents that should be actually split up into different cases, UDP cases, and not be handled in one.
Okay. I'm not sure, and maybe Christine can enlighten us, what happens in that kind of case where you suddenly have multiple respondents instead of a single one?
This is Christine. Well, we offer our complainants two choices. So there are people who use sort of address spoofing services that so there's one underlying registrant actually, but they've provided false details to the registrar. But all of the IP addresses or whatever it is can be traced back to the single registrant. So we do allow a chance at this point for our complainants to set up a chain link and explain in their complaint that these really are actually underlying the same registrant. And if they feel like they can do that, they're allowed to go forward. The risk there is that the panel will look at the complaint, call bullshit, and dismiss some of the complaint. You know, dismiss some of the domain names and say no, these are really against different registrants. But if they're really against different registrants, the complainant can't make any sort of colorable argument. Then the complainant at that point has to decide which underlying registrants it wants to proceed against, and then the case will go forward at that point against those underlying registrants. And then the other will be dismissed out, and the complainants may feel free to file again if they wish, you know, to go against the other domain names. The problem is when a registrar has locked the domain name promptly and everything's locked down, and then some sort of a third party, and not necessarily the kind that's a company related to the registrar, but some true third-party provider comes back and says, oh, yeah, I guess there was a privacy service 2 weeks later. Well, now it's notified its five customers of the, and then we get five different responses. That's where the drama comes in. That's why we are really opposed to, you know, this sort of ability for people to come, you know, these third-party, and I use third-party loosely because I understand Volker's point that technically some of these privacy practice services are not actually the registrar. It's a subsidiary of the registrar or whatever. But my concern is if you've got an actual third-party provider who's really just sort of the registrant covering up for these underlying people, and then they come back weeks later, that's really where the problem comes in. It's not the people that go within their internal system or find something within 24 or 48 hours.
Okay, thank you. I have a question for registrars, I guess, and that is, you know, if it's your own captive proxy service, or it has a name of the company, you know, equivalent to, you know, proxyservice.com or something, that's fine. How do you know someone is a proxy service? How do you distinguish between a company that is, or a lawyer that's acting as a proxy or a privacy provider and changes the registrant, and someone who changes the registrant falsely, equivalent to CyberFlight? How does the registrar actually recognize a legitimate, given that right now they're not, they're not accredited by ICANN or anyone else, how do you recognize a proxy provider?
Yeah, I'd like to answer to that. In many cases, that's not possible. In those cases where it is not possible, we treat them as a registrant. In other cases, it's plainly visible because of the name when it says domains by proxy, proxy domain, proxy service. In some cases, we just know it because it's the same address as the reseller through which the domain was registered. And when they say, when it's not a name but a proxy service or a domain admin registered through and something like that. So it's a bit of a mixture between experience and actual knowledge. This will probably become more clear once the actual proxy service accreditation comes through,
sure,
which we're working on at the moment. But currently, we only treat those that are plainly visible as proxy services as such.
Okay, that's a good answer. Marika, back to you, I think.
This is Marika. We're actually on the top of the hour. I don't know if you want to continue further or people have other commitments.
Oh, you're right. We are on the hour. We didn't get many items done, but I think we had an interesting meeting. When is our next one, Marika? Do we know what our next one is?
Exactly. I mean, I propose that we just continue again on the same schedule, but then the question is whether people want to meet next week, which I can tell you that the ICANN offices are closed, so preferably we don't schedule any calls in that week. So then the next one would either be the 3rd of January or 10th of January if people will prefer to take a little bit more time off during.
My inclination is to say on the 3rd we're still going to have a fair number of people who take the rest of that week off. And my inclination is to say let's hold the next one on the 10th. Is there any strong opposition to that, given that McKaylee isn't here to object? And I don't know if he's working that week at all or not.
If Volker has his hand up, but I don't know if he's objecting.
Oh, that's a vestigial hand, but I can answer to that as well. I will be gone till the second week of January, but
okay.
Go ahead without me.
No. We will cancel our meeting in deference to you.
Oh, that's so nice.
Next meeting will be held on Thursday, the 10th of January, if I have the date correct.
Perfect.
And I do.
That sounds perfect.
Thank you all for a good meeting. I wish you all a happy holiday season, and don't eat too much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for stepping in.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Happy holidays to all.